Hello and welcome to the Autism Mums podcast.
I'm Victoria.
And I'm Natalie.
We're two sisters raising autistic children who know the joy, the challenges and the everyday moments.
This is a supportive space for honest conversations, practical tips, shared strength and expert advice.
Whether you're celebrating a win, surviving a meltdown or just trying to make it through the day, we're right here with you.
Join us as we share the ups, the downs, and everything in between parenting autistic children. Hi, it's Natalie. Unfortunately, I was unable to be in today's interview, but before we begin, I just wanted to say hello and let you know it's a really good one. Hopefully you'll agree.
That's right. Today I'm joined by a really special guest, Tanya Kemp. Tanya is a registered counsellor and parent consultant specialising in neurodiversity, trauma, and the parent-child connection. Tanya's own journey has equipped her with unique insights on supporting autistic children.
If you've ever felt overwhelmed or unsure in your parenting journey, this episode has some really valuable practical advice and stories that we hope will be helpful to you. Okay, let's hand over to Victoria and Tanya.
Welcome to the podcast, Tanya.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So you've taken quite an unconventional path, I guess you would say, in supporting your daughter. So I wondered if you could start by talking a little bit about your journey with her and how you found your way to neurodiversity affirming parenting.
My daughter was really young when I started noticing differences in her. She was diagnosed autistic when she was just 17 months old, which is quite young. And by that stage, I had already done a master's in psychology. And so I was quite attuned to developmental milestones and what they would look like. I'd been working with families with multiple and complex needs already for about 10 years. So I was already in the field, but not specializing in autism in particular. When she was diagnosed and we were basically directed by the psychologist in terms of this is the therapy that you need to do, it just didn't really resonate with me. It just didn't feel to me like this is what I wanted for my daughter, you know, for in her terms of her long-term development and her life. And so I started to dig really deep into all the autism interventions and what therapy would look like and autism in particular. And that kind of steered me on a path of studying relationship development intervention and DIR floor time and Stuart Shanker self-reg programs, which was all based around relationships, development, and nervous system safety. And that path really got me into the circles of really listening to autistic adults and how autistic adults talk about their experience of therapy and what that meant for them as adults now in the world. So I was really very strongly influenced by that. I spent hours and hours just reading autistic adult experiences. And then I suppose with my background in psychology, did a deep dive into the research and what people were saying and was the gold standard and what they were really measuring in those gold standard studies. So that's why I decided what I'm going to go with meeting my daughter where she's at, assuming that she's competent, assuming that she is communicating, even though it's different to what we would expect her to do. And yes, that's when I started practicing in this area. And the more I practiced, the more I learned from the families that I worked with. And that was helpful because I was able to help families better, but I was able to help my daughter better and understand her better. So it's been this dual learning process, both to help others, but really essentially to help my daughter.
That's really fascinating. So useful that you had that background as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Who or what would you say has the biggest impact on autistic children's success?
Parents. I think like every human being that comes into this world, our parents or primary caregivers are the ones who has most impact. Nobody knows their child better. Nobody is more invested in their child. And it's always so interesting to me how parents will doubt themselves in the beginning. They'll think, oh, I need to listen to all the professionals. I need to do what people tell me to do. Even when often they will later say, that kind of went against my gut instinct. That went against what I really felt like I needed to do. And sometimes it can take years before parents actually start to trust themselves, right? Children learn through relationship, and those initial relationships, that first relationship with the primary caregivers, is the most impactful on a child's life, I think.
Yeah,
Yeah, that makes sense. And what you say about learning to trust yourself as parents. My son had the eating issues. And I remember being told, he'll eat when he's hungry. You just put it in front of him. He'll eat when he's hungry. He did not eat when he was hungry. And it did go against my instincts. But do what we learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's never too late, right? Just like it's never too late for our children to learn and develop and grow, it's never too late for us as parents to take on a new path and begin again. It's a journey. We don't have to get it right from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a bit about ways to discuss your child's diagnosis with them that is in a positive way?
I always say that the earlier you start to talk about the brain and different people having different brains and spotlighting things that are different for different people, and in saying that, focusing not just the challenges, but certainly focusing just on the things that are different, and some of those are strengths as well. So always talk about you bake the cake first by mentioning, oh wow, I noticed that you really focused on this thing, that you were doing this. You can really focus on Minecraft for so long. That's one of the things that your brain is really good at. It goes into this attention tunnel, right? Whereas my brain is here, there, and everywhere. So you're just spotlighting differences, talking about some brains. I always say to parents, say, talk about some brains like this and some brains do that. And it's not so much about better or worse. And then I think later, as children get older, they really start to adopt that language as well, and they start to recognize, these things are more different for my brain. It's not that I'm bad at them. It's not that I'm broken. It's not that there's something wrong with me. It's my brain does better with this type of thing. Then later, as they get older, we start to talk about the umbrella of neurodiversity, right? So there are many people like you. There are many people with brains that develop differently. You're not the only one. You're not the outsider. You're just like many others like you. But the majority of brains are like this. And so that's why sometimes things can be difficult and we can have misunderstandings. I think the younger you start, the more natural it is. It just becomes part of your day-to-day life and conversations. And also, I think, again, it's never too late, because sometimes when children are older, having that understanding of their brain can give a real sense of relief and just, ah, oh, it's not that I'm broken. It's not that I'm not a good neurotypical. I'm a good neurodivergent person. Everything that I'm experiencing is valid for how I am wired. I think that changes the narrative, that changes the picture a little bit, even though it can still be difficult, of course, because the world isn't built for neurodivergent brains. There are very real challenges going alongside with being neurodivergent, but at least it's not because you're bad at being neurotypical. It's just the world is built for neurotypical brains.
Yeah, I really like that. I remember a friend of mine shared a video when my son was going through the diagnosis process, and we knew he was going to get his diagnosis, and he was struggling so much at the time. And she sent me a video, it was a cartoon one, and it explained a child who was having difficulties with sensory things, eating food, things that he struggled with. And I got him to watch it, and it just explained autism, really. And you could see he was like, that's like me. And it was like a relief in him, I think. So, yeah, that's
Absolutely.
amazing.
I did the same thing. I showed my daughter videos, and the ones that she resonated with, she did watch them over and over again because that's how her brain works. And it was so validating. I remember she was about 4 or 5, and she watched a video about Greta Thunberg and how about the environment. And she described some things about herself. My daughter was just glued to the screen, and she was like, that's what I'm like. I'm exactly like her. I can't stop thinking about the same thing. And so it was really meaningful to me, because I thought she self-identified, she noticed, and she looked up to somebody who she was able to identify with.
Yeah, that's so important. That's really good. So, on that note, how do you think we can give our children more opportunities for agency?
Well, I think that's a really big question. I think one of the first things that we can do to support our children with agency is just in the way that we communicate. I think from the really early years, when our children are different and when they don't respond to us in the way that we expect them to respond, we start changing how we communicate, because we're trying to get a response. We're trying to create that feedback loop, that reciprocity. And so we end up using a very particular type of language. called instrumental language, which is means to an end language, asking questions, sometimes questions that we already know the answer to, or just asking questions for the sake of asking questions. Also, prompting. We tell our kids what to do all the time instead of leaving space for them to think and have agency around doing even simple things. Just the way if you use declarative language and say something like, here's your dinner, and you put it down instead of saying, take a bite. Like you're saying, here's your dinner. There's an opportunity for your child to have agency and start eating instead of just following an instruction. Or, oh, it looks cold outside. I'm going to put my jacket on and look at their jacket and wait and give them time. You're giving a very small opportunity for them to actually make the choice. And that agency is so critical for internal intrinsic motivation and independent thinking and ultimately problem solving. It's critical for a child's well-being to have agency, and we have opportunities to give up agency in very small moments throughout life simply by not prompting everything and slowing ourselves down, giving indirect information, and waiting for our child to make a choice. And it's not about having passive aggressive, oh, I'm going to say this and hope that you will do the thing that I want you to do. It really is about being in a mindset of, I have space, I have time, I'm going to scaffold this interaction, and I'm going to give my child the opportunity, the time that he needs or she needs to process and make a decision. And I think there are many, many opportunities for that throughout the day in everyday life.
Oh, I could do more of that. That's useful. That's useful. I think sometimes we can get very wrapped up in we've got to get out the door. We've got to do this. We've got to do this without leaving that room.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
good
Yeah. And even
advice.
just not even just in getting things done, but in simple experience sharing ways. We're so often stuck, like you say, in getting things done, getting out the door, moving through our schedule or our routine, but just making comments and not expecting anything in return. Waking up and saying, oh, I had such a terrible sleep, and not go, why do you think I had a terrible sleep? Or how did you sleep? Just sharing. Again, it's an opportunity for your child to think about and decide whether they want to share their experience as well. It's very interesting when you look at this because, in general conversation, we use comments and just experience sharing language all the time. Our conversation now is really all about experience sharing. And yet, with autistic children, we don't communicate in that way. We're so focused on the things that need to get done. We don't slow down enough to comment and wait and be okay with the fact that our child might not respond. Just to be okay with that because they might not respond, and we don't need to force that response because then again, that takes their agency away as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what have been your top three most important lessons learned in parenting an autistic child?
The first one is myself. I learned that I needed to do a lot of work on myself to be able to be available for my daughter. I really needed to understand my triggers, understand how to manage those triggers, how to regulate myself. I think a lot of the difficult times we perhaps had when she was younger was just as much tied to my dysregulation as it was to hers. So that was, I would say, probably the biggest lesson was to focus on myself, look at myself first, before I'm just trying to look at her and see what I need to fix. Which the second thing I think is about the fixing is that there is no fixing to be done. There's learning about who she is and adapting, with me being the adult, adapting to create an environment in which she can be herself, learn in a way that makes sense to her brain, and be validated versus focusing on what I need to fix. Of course, I use strategies and parenting approaches that will help her to regulate better, to make her life easier, and make her more open for learning and engagement. But it's not about fixing who she is. And I think the third biggest lesson I've learned is to ask for help, to not see myself as failing when things are difficult, because they will be difficult. No matter how well we're doing, no matter how regulated we are, as often as we can, there will always be struggles because the world is sometimes, I think, really, really threatening to her. And there's a lot of things that I have to think about, a lot of things to control. And so that becomes a lot. And I think asking for help, being vulnerable, letting people know where the pain points are and when you need help the most, I think that has been a very critical point of something for me to learn, because we sometimes feel we have to be perfect and we have to do everything, and because we do it best, we want to do it all. But I don't think we can always be our best unless we ask for help.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think when you were saying that, I know I certainly had to rethink the way that I approached parenting. I thought that being a good parent was, for example, in the summer holidays, I plan something every day. I'm going to take you on all this fun stuff. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. Not realizing at the beginning that this is really overwhelming, and that was not what that looked being. Happy, or he just couldn't deal with that. That wasn't the way to parent him. I'm
Yeah.
going to take you to London. We're going to go skating. We're going to go to a show. Oh, that's like horror. So it was,
Absolutely.
yeah, it's a lot of recalibrating what you think is good as opposed to what they need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the key things for me as a parent, and I think for most of the parents that I work with, is the art of slowing down. Just knowing that you have a child who processes things differently, slowly, more intensely, and they need a lot of downtime. They need a lot of time to process. And if you give them that time, then you see them regulated. So then you see development speed up, right? But more isn't better. And the same is true even for therapies. More isn't better. Actually, less is more. We've got to prioritize and slow yourself down and trust the process with our kids.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Well, I will say he does like London. He likes the idea of it. But what he likes to do, he would like to go to a hotel and stay there. So, yeah, my husband had a very interesting trip when we went because he's like, no, I love it. I love the hotel. But the plan was to stay in the hotel room and,
Yeah.
be on his iPad. Certainly didn't want to walk around the crowds or things like that. But so, in his own way, if you asked him if he liked London, he'd be like, yeah. Love the hotel, love the swimming pool.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I love that. That's such a great example of just looking at the world differently and enjoying something that other people don't necessarily enjoy. It doesn't mean he's not enjoying it. And then that sometimes leads to that conflict. Well, this is what we enjoy. This is what I like to do. Why can't you like that too? This is what other kids enjoy. And so there's that kind of conflict of interest sometimes there.
Yeah, 100%. We had to split up. So I took our daughter to the theatre, to the ice skating. And on that trip, it was my husband who stayed in the hotel a lot. And he was like, oh, okay, this isn't what I had planned. But we bear it in mind now when we go on trips or when we're considering it. So if you're a parent who's struggling with co-parenting your autistic children, sometimes I know there can be tensions between how we want to approach things differently, and you can feel that loss of connection. Do you have any advice for couples?
Yeah, I think that's really difficult, and it's something that I come across a lot. And of course, every family's situation is very unique. I often do an exercise with parents around trying to get on the same page and thinking about the longer term goals that they want for their children. Sometimes we're just parenting to get through the day. We just want the behavior to stop. We just want this to end. But when we can zoom out and we can look at the bigger picture, who you want your child to be when they're 21, how you want them to feel about themselves, how you want them to look at the world, it shifts a little bit how you show up in the day-to-day as well. So I try to help couples to zoom out and get that joint goal and joint perspective. And then I think it's important to prioritize what needs to be addressed now and what do we need to shelve. We can't solve all the problems immediately, right? So if we can come to a point where we're agreeing on what the priority is right now and then give each other a little bit of room to be ourselves, right? We're not supposed to be the exact same parent. Like each parent, no matter how they show up, they bring something that child needs, and we need to respect and honor that in each other. And if we're starting to look at each other as partners, as someone that brings something that you can't bring, and you play to each other's strengths, you identify, well, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what you're going to do, because this is what I'm good at, and this is what you're good at, instead of you're not doing that, and I need more help with that, and becoming more from that place of defensiveness and accusing each other. I think there can be a lot of progress made if you approach things in that way. So I do a lot of work with couples because couples' relationships start to falter as well when the home environment is essentially very stressful. And sometimes it's important for couples to have their own therapy because now their buttons are getting pushed in a completely different way that doesn't even have anything to do with the child. So again, it's important to understand what are the real issues here. Is this about parenting, or is this about unfulfilled hopes and dreams in the relationship, or a lack of connection? And then prioritize and figure out where do we start. And recognize and accept that this is again also a process. We're not going to fix everything today or next week or even next month, and that's okay. We are on a journey. We are recalibrating after having a child that's not how we expected. With the parenting playbook doesn't work. We have to figure everything out, and people learn at a different pace. So I think it's again similar to how you would approach your child, is meeting each other where you're at. Trusting the other that to have an important role and an important impact, and then knowing your goals and your strengths in working towards those goals.
That's really good advice. As you work with a lot of couples and families, what do you think people most appreciate in your approach?
I think what people appreciate most in my approach is the fact that I've lived all of this myself. Like, I've had the relationship struggles, I've had the struggles in with myself, I've had the disappointment and the mourning of the family I didn't have, and then the guilt about mourning the family I didn't have because I do have a wonderful family at the same time. And I think that parents really appreciate that I really get it. I really get it from both ends, from a professional point of view, from a parent point of view, and as well as a co-parent. Because I think this is a very unique experience. Being a parent of an autistic child is an incredibly unique experience. And I don't know if you found this, but it doesn't really matter how much you explain to people. People never really get it. You feel like I've just given them a great explanation of why my child just did this or how I feel. And then they'll do or say something the next minute that makes you realize, oh no, you really don't get this. So I think having somebody who's walked in their shoes is probably the most valuable thing I bring.
I would say that's so valuable. Yes, I know. I've been in that position. So many, I'm sure, with I've had relatives who I thought really understood. And then, for example, at a restaurant, they were not impressed with my son not eating. And I thought you understood this. I thought we were very clear about this. And you think, yeah, so I don't think that's, what's the word? You can't put a value on that. You having that background, I think that's amazing for your clients.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have clients that I've worked with, seen their kids through from kindergarten going into high school. I think just having that person that kind of walk beside you is just incredibly valuable because it's often a very lonely road, just for that reason, that you can explain to your friends and even your family and still really feel alone in the hard moments. Because when things become difficult, that's mostly when you see people not really getting it and reverting to, well, children should be doing this, and this, you're letting them get away with this, and you should be parenting differently or better. So I think, and that's very difficult to hear because we do doubt ourselves a lot anyway. And when trusted people say these things to you, it can be hard to hold your ground. But that's another skill that takes years to fully acquire and master, if ever.
Yeah, 100%. So, how do you work with clients? Is it online, face to face?
Yeah, so I do basically all my work now online since COVID. I've gone fully online, and it's been really good. It didn't really change much in terms of the quality of the work. Sometimes I will see the children in the families when I go and observe them at schools, and sometimes I'll do assessments where I observe the family's interaction with each other. But really, I'm very rarely in the space with the families, especially even when they're working on goals that we've identified, because again, I'm not the primary guide. I have to coach the parents to be the primary guides. Like, I can try to interact with this child, but that there's a completely different dynamic going on there. This child doesn't know me, might learn to trust me, but I'm not there every single day. And the way that I work isn't about 2 hours of therapy per week. This is about a family starting to understand their whole new family dynamic, starting to understand how the home environment changes, how the communication environment needs to change, how to advocate at school, how to create experiences in the home where a child has agency and can build on co-regulation skills. And that's every single day. That's in the small day-to-day things. It's not a separate activity in a therapy room, and then we go back to our usual lives. And because that is really the goal of my work, I very much use my clinical counseling background, but it's also very much coaching of parents. We'll watch videos of parents interacting with their child with the goals that we had in mind, and we will analyze it together. Be like, do you notice what happened there? Do you notice what your child did and you missed that? Or that was really good when you waited long enough for them to finally give their own authentic response. And so parents see themselves interact with their kids, and I think that's a very powerful learning experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of the teaching that you do, you have a very generous gift for our listeners.
Yes, well, I actually have a couple of things available. On my website, I have a 5-day free video series for parents whose children have just been diagnosed, which kind of talks through the parent mindset and considering therapy and thinking about school advocacy and kind of covers a lot of the areas that parents want to think about when they've just received a diagnosis. And sometimes it's because they've been on the wrong path. And then that video series is helpful as well when it feels like things aren't working and you want to rethink your priorities or your approach with your child. I talk a lot about communication, and there's a really helpful communication overhaul PDF and cheat sheet on my website as well that listeners can download. And there's some guidance, and then there's a checklist that you can put up on the fridge for as daily reminders to slow down in communication and offer more opportunities for dynamic communication versus just questions and prompts, which we so often do.
Oh, they both sound so valuable. Thank you ever so much. And can you share the address for your website? We'll put everything in the show notes, but just for anyone listening.
Sure, the address is www.tanyakemp.com.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, Tanya. It's been really interesting talking to you. I've learned a lot.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely talking to you as well, Victoria.
Thanks for joining us today on the Autism Mums podcast. We hope you have found a little support, a little solidarity, and a reminder that you are not in this alone. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd love it if you'd follow the show and share it with another parent or carer who might need to hear it. And if you've got a story or a moment you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you at www.theautismmums.com. Until next time, take care.